We are all anxious to start the program. This evening with the author is jointly sponsored by the Polish American Congress, the Polish Veterans Association, with Dr. Koper. I don't know if Dr. Koper had a chance to come in. And with the Friends of Solidarity, Dr. Mihaida. To introduce the author, we are honored to have a man who really needs no introduction. A man who represented President Carter, who was the director of the National Security Council, and who is a very close friend of our Mr. Jan Nowak. And without any further ado, let me ask Dr. Brzezinski, who unfortunately has other previous commitments, and I understand that he will spend just a short time with us. Dr. Brzezinski, please.
Colonel Leonard, Mr. Nowak, ladies and gentlemen, and the program indicates that my task this evening is to introduce Jan Nowak, but that seems to me to be a totally redundant assignment. Everyone in this room knows Jan Nowak, either personally or by reputation, and I have been privileged to know him myself for some 30-odd years. If there is ever a person in the Polish community who doesn't need an introduction, it truly is Jan Nowak. We all know him from his wartime exploits. We all know him from his dedicated service to Poland and to the United States and to the cause of freedom more generally after World War II. We all know him from his memoirs, The Courier from Warsaw. And we also all know that in addition to having risked his life in being a courier from Warsaw, he dedicated the rest of his life to being a courier to Warsaw, a courier from the free world who for many a year made certain that Poland, while cut off from the West, while isolated behind the Iron Curtain, remained internally conscious of its past, aware of its present, and dedicated to its own self. There are many ways of assessing the contribution that Jan made to that cause, and certainly his talk tonight, based on his book, involves a very important service, that of keeping Poland informed about what is and was transpiring within itself and around it during the years when so much of an effort was made to mislead, to misinform, and to reshape the national consciousness. The fact that the radio which he directed not only pierced the wall of isolation, but in fact became the central source of information about Poland for the Poles itself, is a monumental achievement. But I think his service goes beyond that, and it is on this that I'd like briefly to comment. I think in many ways the most important accomplishment that Jan achieved and represents is that in the post-World War II years, his efforts to speak to Poland represented nothing less than a school of political thinking for a country which was badly in need of a sense of political direction and political thought. During World War II, Poland suffered not only physical devastation, but above all, the decapitation of its political elite. And that process was continued under Stalin. And perhaps the most pervasive damage done by the Stalinist regime to Poland was the continued process of the deliberate destruction of Polish political thought through the physical liquidation of independent political activists and through the suppression of any genuine political dialogue about the future of Poland. The rebirth of Poland in 1919, for example, was preceded by an intense period of highly dynamic political thinking, ranging from the socialists to the National Democrats, and series of doctrines about the future of Poland emerged. Between 1945 and the mid-50s, a concerted effort was made in Poland to prevent any from that from transpiring. Radio Free Europe under Jan's tutelage not only informed Poland about what was transpiring in Poland, but it helped Poles to think realistically about their political condition, which is the necessary point of departure for the revival of political life. And I put a lot of emphasis on the word realistic. These were not attempts to stir up hopeless uprisings, to feed unwarranted illusions, but rather to encourage systematic thought about what it is feasible to attain within the limits of the status quo, and thereby expand the frontiers of liberty, to reawaken political life, and to nurture a sense of political identity. I think the best testimony to the success and to the historical significance of his efforts is what has transpired in Poland in recent years. For Solidarity, and this evening is sponsored in part by the Friends of Solidarity, was the expression of the revival of political life in Poland, of the reappearance of an authentic political thought and of an authentically Polish political elite. And that would not have been possible without Jan's efforts. And therefore I say in all sincerity that his historical contribution to Poland is truly unique and goes far beyond piercing the Iron Curtain with information. It has been to recreate authentic political thought, to contribute to the reemergence of authentic political life. And while Solidarity institutionally has been suppressed, it has scored a triumph which lives, and that is the reawakening of political and historical consciousness in Poland, which dominates social and political life in Poland. And that triumph of Solidarity is very much also Jan's triumph, and this is why I'm so pleased to be able to salute him here tonight. Thank you.
Dr. Brzeziński, ladies and gentlemen, 33 years ago, a young scholar from Harvard asked to see me in Munich, and Mr. Paul Henze, who is here tonight and who was arranging this meeting, said, don't spare your time with this young man. He has a very bright future. He may become a star one day. Well, after talking for 2 hours with Dr. Brzeziński, who just got his doctoral degree at the Harvard University, well, I told myself Paul was right, but I never really guessed that I was talking to the future advisor to the President of the United States, a strategist who had such strong imprint on the policy of superpower. And I would never dream that I will have a privilege and honor to be introduced to this distinguished gathering by such celebrity. And Zbyk, I truly appreciate that in your very busy schedule you did find time to come and to introduce me. And I know how busy you are. I am a little embarrassed because I am not sure if I really deserved all these kind words that you said.
Thank you.
Well, I see other friends here. My form, incidentally, there are some free chairs here, and the people are standing over there. Maybe some of guests would like to sit in front. Well, I see other friends. My former bosses and American associates from Radio Free Europe. The people who could say, well, that I was a very difficult customer. And some of them probably said that I am a damn nuisance. But still, the very fact that we did have differences of opinion, that we even quarreled, proves that with the Americans you may even have sharp clash of opinion and still remain lifelong friend. And this is, to me, one of the most attractive aspects of the American society and American system. I also see some young faces here in the back, and I wonder how many of people here were listening to Radio Free Europe in Poland. Let me repeat this question in Polish. Kto z Państwa słuchał Radia Wolna Europa w Polsce? Można poprosić o podniesienie? Well, many. I will tell you this, I had 14 evenings like this, 7 in Europe, 7 in United States, and everywhere the majority of the audience were my former listeners. And your presence here have some special significance to me. Because I remember the inauguration program of Radio Free Europe on May 3rd, 1952. Most of my young listeners and friends today were not even born, and it was the time when the darkness of Stalinist night was all over Poland, not a ray of hope on the horizon, and in spite of it, in my inauguration speech, I introduced some little bit of optimism. I said that the day will come when the freedom will dawn over Poland again. And then, as soon as I finished, a well-known expert on Soviet affairs, very highly respected by Poles and by Americans, came to me and said, Jan, I appreciate your enthusiasm, but you know, we must be realists and we have to know what the truth is. Look at the experience of the Soviet Ukraine between the wars. In 25 years from now, the people who are born today or later will still speak Polish but think Soviet. Poland will be only a place on the map. It was awfully difficult to answer such gloomy prophecy at that time. And immediately, what he said brought to my mind a very sad experience from the World War II, when my wife and I were crossing Germany on our way to London, and in a small village, Kapellertelle, near the Swiss border, we met two young Russians who were maybe 15, maybe 16, only 3 or 4 years older than Mr. Gorbachev, same generation, and we engaged in political discussion. And I was terrified to see that they are like gramophone records. They were repeating all the slogans of Pravda and Izvestia with full conviction. They were not within the reach of KGB. They were deported for forced labor from Orel to this place in West Germany, and still they were simply repeating Soviet propaganda, a typical example of what Goebbels called Bildung der öffentlichen Meinung, and the Soviets call shaping of socialist consciousness, and the American called brainwashing. He belonged to the generation which was brought up under conditions, full conditions of the monopoly of state monopoly of education and propaganda, in a society hermetically sealed off from any outside influence. And the final product was captive mind. And I cannot help to think about Mr. Gorbachev, who was belonged to the same generation. And I think that even the most persuasive American communicator may have difficulties in changing this man's perception of the West and of the United States. The system of negative and positive values were hammered into the mind of these people from their early childhood with such force that even if Gorbachev would see all the affluence and opulence of our society, our swimming pools, our beautiful buildings, number of cars and so on, his brain computer will instantly translate it into terms of Marxism, Leninism. He will say, that's just the fruit of the colonial exploitation. Well, frankly, I was afraid that in 25 years, maybe the Polish young generation will just be like these gramophone records, like these two Russians I met. I was wrong. I was wrong because Eastern Europe was much more lucky than the people of the Soviet Union. BBC and Voice of America continued their broadcasts after the war, and totalitarian system of propaganda is losing its effectiveness if it cannot deny people access to other sources of information. If such alternative source of information, views, does exist, if people can compare different point of views, then they preserve independence of mind. And only people who remain independent in their own mind can really exert effective pressure on their governments, even totalitarian governments. Well, this was the basic, I believe, difference. And I learned for the first time, I would dare to say that if in this period of time between 1917 and 1948, when VOA and BBC started the Russian broadcast, there would be a network of shortwave radio stations broadcasting to the population of the Soviet Union, perhaps we would be facing an entirely different reality today, because people would remain independent in their own mind. I learned myself the power of political broadcasting from my own experience when I escaped from the German captivity at the end of September 39, and for the first time in my life I tuned on BBC and heard Polish program. I was totally despondent at that time. I was apathetic. The Polish state collapsed in 4 weeks under the powerful blows from the Soviet Union and German Reich. My university was closed. I saw no purpose of life, no sense of life. And in this half an hour, I learned that the Polish government has been formed in France, that Polish army is being formed in France, that war is going on, that the Allies are determined to continue, that we lost only the battle, but the war continues, and that we can still win. In a matter of 1 hour, I was an entirely different man. I regained my will to live and my purpose of life and my will to fight. And judging from my own experience, I'm convinced that BBC was the mother of resistance of occupied Europe and contributed greatly to the victory over Germany. You will not find it in any memoirs of any generals. You will not find it in any war literature. But in order to really confirm what I said, go to the National Archives and see what the German assessment of the damage inflicted by the resistance in their own documents, which are now available for the public. So you may imagine my feeling where after being for 5 years at the receiving end, I found myself for the first time in my life in Busch House, in the studio. And after this familiar signal, boom, 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 for the first time I said, to movie London, this is London. I was aware that millions of people are listening, and I was aware of the impact. Well, we had to start, I had to start by going through the training course. And there were a set of rules which sounded obvious. Credibility is a precondition of influence. Separation of news and views. Reliability is the only criterion of selection of news. Reliability before speed, and above all, bad news first. Now, during the first 2 or 3 years of war, all news were bad, but they were then put in proper context by comments that followed the news, and that softened their impact. And above all, it creates such credibility that when the time of victories came, everybody, even Germans, even hostile audience, believed BBC and were listening to the BBC, not to their own radio, to BBC. Well, we all believed BBC like a gospel. We believed in absolute objectivity of BBC. And the first thing we were told, there is no such thing as absolute objectivity. There are many ways to present everything in objective way. You pick up the one, the version, the variation which suits best the objective of the BBC. In other words, news and commentaries should sound objective. It seemed to me a little bit cynical, but correct. Well, then the British were acting on assumption that BBC has competition, that British cannot deny access to other sources of the information. Therefore, they were teaching us that broadcasting has its limitations. It cannot, they didn't believe like Hitler or Stalin that one can make people believe that white is black or vice versa. They thought radio can do only one thing. It can activate the attitudes, the inclinations, the emotions which are already in existence, if dormant. Activate, bring them into full play and vigor, and nothing more. BBC told us we are not rendering any public service to our audience. We want to achieve our objectives. And we want to lead the audience to some conclusions. But they must feel that they have drawn these conclusions themselves. Therefore, you cannot present only one aspect of issue. You have to present in balanced way all the aspects of an issue and let them draw their own conclusions, but lead them to the conclusions we want them to draw. Because, they said, our study shows that only 2% of views which are adopted from others can withstand competition with conflicting views. But own views, people when they consider this is their own conclusion, they will stay. they were telling us that the best way to attract to freedom is to show conflicting views, variety of views, because variety of views is the essence of freedom. And this contrasts with the monotony of the totalitarian propaganda. I think the greatest asset of the BBC was that it was a public corporation totally separated from the government. BBC was not the part of the state bureaucracy. And the government, the Foreign Office, was sending daily guidances which were nothing but information about developments and assessment and official assessment. But they couldn't impose the day-to-day policy. I happened to knew Anurin Bevan, who was the member of the British cabinet. And I had a chance to talk to him after he returned from Poland, where he talked to Prime Minister Cyrankiewicz. And Cyrankiewicz blasted the Polish service of the BBC. And I asked, well, how did you react? And he said, oh, I said, I couldn't agree with you more. I hate this outfit. But Mr. Prime Minister, you have to understand, I have no influence. They are independent. It's a public corporation. I can do nothing. Well, at that time at least, The British embassies were under instructions never to discuss the output of the BBC and never to convey any criticism. They could only monitor us and share their own views and their own reactions. This was tested at the time of the Suez crisis, when Anthony Eden, Prime Minister, did want to prevent BBC from broadcasting the views of the opposition, criticism of the adventure. And John Clark, who was the head of the overseas service, said no. And after all was over, he was knighted by the Queen for taking proper attitude. Well, but the longer I was in the BBC, the more weaknesses I did discover. What was the main weakness? Master scripts, master newscasts, distributed across the board to all the language desks. We were supposed to project British point of view and British style of life. And the news and commentaries were written not from the point of view of the relevance of the audiences, but from the point of view of the relevance to the British. As a result, the news from some remote part of the British Empire were played first. And very rarely any news about Poland. Very rarely, always at the very end. Of course, Polish audience couldn't care less about what was going on in Rhodesia or even in India. They were interested in what was going on in their own country, in their own area, in the Soviet Union, in Germany, in Europe. And we were translators. We were reduced to the role of translator. It was a group of outstanding broadcasters, Polish broadcasters, trained before the war. But we had only to translate. And in the process of translations, the scripts lost their freshness of style, of the language. And of course, I was embarrassed when I had to read a script written by a second-rate British journalist, because the first-rate British journalists were in the Fleet Street writing for the British press, about Poland. It sounded so naive, so simplistic, that I went to my British bosses and said, look, I mean, it sounds awful. It sounds naive. And they said, it's better that we sound naive than indifferent. This was the time when Poland was going through terrible ordeal of Stalinism and all that, and they said, it's better to be naive rather than indifferent, or even ignorant. Well, but the fact is that where the effort was made to explain to them that after all it's in the British interest to defend the ties between Poland and Eastern Europe and Western civilization with the West. And in order to achieve this, you have to defend Polish heritage, Polish national identity. And that it would multiply the influence of the BBC. The answer was, this area is on the fringe of our interests, and our effort should be correspond to our political interests in this area. We don't need to increase our influence beyond some. Well, then, in the fall of 1951, Bill Griffiths made me an offer to organize the Polish operation of Radio Free Europe from scratch, in a matter of few months, literally. Well, Radio Free Europe had entirely different philosophy. First, we were told we will be called Voice of Free Poland. We objected. We said we don't want to claim that we represent anybody but ourselves. Why not to call ourselves Free Voice of Free Poles? No, because it would be then Voice of Exiles. We want you to be Voice of Free Poland. We reluctantly had to accept, and the name was then withdrawn when Cold War was over, and when the audience got used to it. But I got complete freedom to build the program within very broad framework of rules in a manner that would be best attuned to the interest, traditions, mentality of my audience. Total freedom. There was no pre-censorship, and this was, I believe, achievement of the founding fathers like Griffiths and Paul Hensey, and many others, I must tell you that this was the best, the most patriotic generation of Americans I met in my life. The people who were young, former combatants, and who has shown really America at its best, when Americans have to create something big out of nothing in the record time in a so-called crash program. Well, we were who could focus on the developments in Poland, which are of the greatest interest to our audience, and to offer a commodity which the audience could not get either from the BBC, nor from VOA, nor from any other stations. But how to cover domestic developments in the time of Stalin, when we could get almost nothing from Western correspondents, when the Iron Curtain was the Iron Curtain. We had a network of correspondents, Polish correspondents, in Stockholm, in Hamburg, in Berlin, in Bonn, in London, in Paris, in Rome, who were doing nothing but contacting visitors from Poland, contacting sailors from Poland, gathering news which appear on Poland, which appeared in the local papers, sending it all to Munich, where there was a filter called evaluation, headed by Mr. John Adams, who is here in the audience, in this audience today, and who, every report was checked carefully against tremendous amount of facts accumulated by this outfit, so that anything that was not reliable was rejected. I had our listeners considered that there is something magic about a speed with which we could broadcast news from Poland. And I remember the man who said, you must have a network of spies in Poland and some, you know, shortwave sets, because how is it that at 7 in the morning you broadcast the meteorological bulletin about conditions, weather conditions in Warsaw, and I go to the thermometer and see, yes, it's true, it's 10 below zero Celsius. How they know it? It was very simple. Warsaw Radio was broadcasting the same bulletin a few minutes before us, and we repeated it without attribution. And I remember another man who said, well, you know, he was a deputy to the Polish parliament. Of course, if you deny that you have underground in Poland, you simply don't tell us truth. I had a speech in Sejm, in the Polish parliament, and I look around for Western correspondents, there were nobody. And there were very few people there. After the speech, I went to bar with a friend of mine. 4 hours later, I came home, and my wife said, aha, you had a speech in Sejm today. Now, how do you know? Well, Radio Free Europe just gave few sentences. Yeah. Well, how could you know what I was saying in Sejm? And I said, look, I mean, there's no magic. Radio Warsaw did broadcast very short items, which was good, and why shouldn't we repeat this? So monitoring of our enemy was very often a very good source of information. Our research, the fact that we had probably the largest pool of information from Eastern Europe, and that press, for instance, was checked not only for information, but for such details, what kind of cigarettes are being smoked in Poland, because it was good to just mention in a talk that somebody was smoking sport cigarettes. It all created an impression that we are there. Now, initially, Radio Free Europe was only broadcasting from New York, 1 hour, and it had a very subordinate role. It was there only to really serve the exiles, to help them to maintain contacts with their countries. But it was General Lucius Clay who was really a founder of Radio Free Europe, because he came back from Germany immensely impressed by the success of RIAS, American Radio Radio in American Sector of Berlin. And RIAS had only 8 American executives, 600 Germans, was broadcasting the whole day. The editors who had total freedom and broadcasting from the heart of Germany, they were listened by everybody in East Germany. The impact was tremendous. And they didn't broadcast just news and political commentaries. They had even symphonic orchestra. They broadcast everything that normal domestic station is broadcasting. And it was Clay who said, let's have 5 big stations broadcasting to these 5 countries who would serve as a substitute of the free radio in Warsaw, in Prague, in Budapest, and so on. And let the Poles give the same freedom, or Hungarians, as we gave to the Germans in Berlin. And this idea was enthusiastically embraced by very dynamic President C.D. Jackson and by these young Americans, pioneers, who were creating these radios. So it was their rule that there should be no pre-censorship and that the relationship between exiles and Americans should be based on partnership. We were stateless exiles. They were representing superpower. And yet, no guidance became law before it was discussed with me or one of my colleagues from other groups. And we had, there were negotiations. There were cases where I tried to reject the guidance and said it's all nonsense. We cannot possibly follow this kind of guidance. There were changes. But never I was faced with the kind of ultimatum, you obey or else. And I believe that behind it, there was a very sound idea that the Poles must sense that the people, the Poles who broadcast to them, are free. That they are free journalists, that they are not puppets. Well, of course, we did have our differences. In this first stage, which was described in my book, they centered around the treatment of the western border of Poland on other Nisa line. It was a very sensitive subject because we were broadcasting from Munich. And Munich was a center of expellees from Czechoslovakia and from Poland, from Sudetenland and from Silesia. And we argued that if you want to call us Voice of Free Poland, we cannot possibly be silent on the most vital issue of the life and death to the Polish nation. A compromise was found, and it worked this way. We did not editorialize on the issue, but Polish exiles, Polish leaders, had the right to say in their occasional speeches what is the Polish point of view on this issue. And this compromise worked until this team did work with Radio Free Europe, this American team. Later, it came to a crisis on this issue. The second difference was about the interpretation of the policy of liberation. Now, we started in 1952, when Eisenhower and Dulles went to election under the banner Liberation and Rollback. And we couldn't be more happy, but how to achieve this? There was no explanation. We had to guess by the Third World War or just the threat of nuclear weapons and pressure, or maybe it's expected that these people should liberate themselves by uprisings, revolutions. We were strongly against this last possibility because we had the memory of the Warsaw Uprising, of this terrible loss of blood which didn't give us freedom, was still very much alive in our minds. And the policy was ambiguous. And when I came to Munich, I read the guidance of liberation and I found contradictions. On one hand, the guidance said we must not, as we did during the first year of our existence, to exhort our listeners to hope for liberation. And in the same breath, the same guidance said, the West intends to use its great military resources to coerce the Russians into liberating our people. And if Kremlin will make mistake of going to war, there will be war. Now, fortunately, we had the sad experience of exaggerated hopes in the Allies during the World War II, and this sentence never appeared in any Polish script. I had only two differences about this, because our American colleagues understood us very well. The kind of ambiguity existed in New York and in Washington. One, after Berlin riots, Deutsche Presseagentur gave the news that riots spread to former German territories belonging to Poland. There are riots in Szczecin, in several other places, and I refused to broadcast it. And I was told, you are violating the rule, that we don't select news. This news was repeated by media all over the world. Fortunately, there was one route of escape, to request that it should be checked against other sources. And the denial came, the Berlin confirmed from the German sources. But Mr. Ramsey, our correspondent in Hamburg, said, we have Polish sailors who 2 days ago left Szczecin. No riots in Szczecin, no riots in any place, everything is quiet. Unfortunately, we didn't broadcast this news. Also, after Berlin, there was a guidance, so-called guidance number 10, to Czechoslovakia, which was insisting that Czechoslovaks should now pressure Czechoslovak workers to use their strength and to begin hacking away at the Iron Curtain from inside. And I went to my Czech colleague and said, well, what you say? He said, I say nothing. It's harmless as far as Czechoslovaks are concerned. They will not move. We can broadcast this. Well, but we were really created of entirely different kind of material. And at that time, I had a meeting with our bosses who came from New York. And I must say that when I said, look, we went through the tragedy of the Warsaw Uprising. The Polish team will not allow itself to be used as a sort of ignition for another kind of uprising which would surely end in a disaster. But we ourselves have learned that between these two extremes, between surrender, between servility, between docile attitude and violent resistance, there is a great variety of means and ways of resisting the system. In the Stalinist time, there was no solidarity, no underground. The society was totally atomized. People didn't trust each other. And yet, even under in this time of terrible police terror, executions, you know, show trials, people did find instinctively the methods of resistance. For instance, the workers would work only as much as was necessary to avoid reprisals. No more. And cumulatively, this kind of attitude undermined the 6 years plan and brought about a liberalization. In the countryside, the small functionaries, under pressure of their milieu, would sabotage as much as they could the orders to collectivize, to implement collectivization. They were changing sides whenever they could do it without risking their necks. As a result, the collectivization in Poland was much slower than in other countries. And finally, the intelligentsia, the intellectuals, they were simply withdrawing like snails into the privacy of their homes, into four walls of their homes. They were not reading the press. They were not listening to local radio. They were really, in a way, boycotting the regime. And this is very important because this kind of resistance was not conscious. It was behavioral. These people did not realize they were resisting. Our job was to convert this subconscious resistance into the conscious one. But this kind of resistance does exist today in the Soviet Union. There may be no strikes. I don't know. Maybe they are, but we don't know about them. There may be no riots. But there is this kind of subconscious resistance. And this is the factor that creates a motive for Mr. Gorbachev to negotiate arms control. Because he does realize that any further increase of the burden imposed by expansionism and arms race will bring about decline of the growth, decline of labor effectiveness, that the people will have even less incentives to work. So we were trying to make this kind of resistance a conscious resistance by quoting examples from the media, from the communist press. Then we tried to create a social link in a society which, as I said, was completely atomized, where neighbor would distrust neighbor, where everybody would see in a colleague a potential spy. Now, we were told by Andrzej Gwiazda, one of the Solidarity leaders, who wrote an article in jail about Radio Free Europe. And he said, in the Stalinist time, it was enough that somebody in a streetcar would start humming a song of Radio Free Europe from the Hemar Cabaret, and people were starting to exchange understanding smiles, and suddenly they...
W imieniu nas wszystkich, chyba będę szczery, jeśli powiem, że był to jeden z najciekawszych wieczorów spędzonych przez nas w San Francisco, za co dziękujemy serdecznie.
Proszę Państwa, bardzo przepraszam, bardzo dziękuję panu Janowi Nowakowi, panu profesorowi doktorowi Leszczyńskiemu. Bardzo przepraszam, panie lekkie zamieszanie.
Może założył,
że ja miałem całkowite, tak powiem, przekonanie, że naród polski wygra.
Bo chodzi mi o to, żeby nazwiska nie przekręcić. A imię?
Grzegorz.
Zatrzymać to. Koniec wieczoru autorskiego pana Jana Nowaka w San Francisco w Kalifornii 9 maja 1980 roku, który miał miejsce w domu polskim. Koniec.